fairly shortly. I'm going to, give me 1 second, I'm going to see if I can make it in and start recording at this point by hitting... Okay, I'm back, and hopefully now the recording's going to start, and we can go ahead and begin. Dave, first of all, thanks for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Is the quality of the audio from my end okay? Because this room has a little bit of an echo.
Yeah, I think it's probably not 100% ideal, but it's certainly comprehensible.
All right, let me see if I can just pick up the phone here instead of speaker. Hold on. Is that better?
Oh, that is a little bit better, yeah.
All right, why don't I just do this? I just have to re-coordinate the logistics of my desk here.
No problem.
So this will work best if you have a copy of the presentation in front of you, and Glenn sent the hyperlink. This report is or presentation is on the ICANN website under the ESSAC documents hyperlink. And sort of a little bit of background, the report is entitled Information Gathering Using Domain Name Registration Records. Information gathering is a term in security that is commonly used by both security professionals and attackers in describing basically the sort of investigatory or surveillance phase that is a precursor to an attack. It's also used in the forensics world as a term that represents trying to find out, or gather evidence. Evidence is always a tough word to use because evidence has a legal connotation, but trying to gather information about an incident to determine what happened. So it's part of what's called an incident response. We're going to use it more in terms of the surveillance and target acquisition context today. So the objectives of this particular effort that I undertook after asking Steve some license for pouring some time and attention into this matter was to essentially approximate the extent to which personal information might be extracted from domain name records as a starting point. So by no means does it suggest that the domain name registration records are in and of themselves entirely useful, in a vacuum to go off and find addresses. They may be, but that's not necessarily the way that people would use them.
Dave, this is Steve Metalitz. Did you want to have questions at the end, or could I interrupt with one now?
Well, I think I'm perfectly happy to make this interactive. So, the only constraint is that the more questions we ask, the less I'll be able to get in. So, why don't we just ask some questions and do that?
Yeah. Okay. I just wondered what led up to this to this work that you've done. Were you asked by the committee to do this, or what was the step prior to your initiating this study?
Well, the step, I guess part of this was sort of a growing sense that a fair number of people in the community talk a great deal about the presence or absence of personal information in the WHOIS without a whole lot of concrete numbers or any sort of research or data on the extent to which personal information is actually present. So I had talks with the policy staff, I had talks with ESSAC, I'd spent a fair amount of time in the audience in a number of the WHOIS and GNSO sessions in Marrakesh, and I concluded, maybe it's worth my while to go off and just take a look at this. But there was there's no motive other than, let me see what the numbers look like.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So moving on, I'm not going to go over the definition of personal contact information, but just to be clear on slide three, I had to choose a definition, and this is the definition that I chose. There may be other definitions of personal contact information, but for me, what I was looking for was, is there enough information here that could lead me to find someone? You know, and I didn't want to overload it by, you know, by adding any sort of legalese or any sort of context with, you know, with any U.S. or international regulations or privacy laws. I just wanted to come up with a definition that was a working definition for the study. I think more interestingly was kind of identifying the methodology so that people had a sense that this was not a scripted program that ran through 60,000 records and ignored fields that didn't make any sense or didn't compare to a string argument. This was a hand, you know, a hand and eye exercise. The way that someone might go and try to find, you know, a useful target of a web attack is very similar to the way that I actually went through the domain name registration data that I had. So I began with a potential set of targets, and that set of targets was a list or a set of 5,000 registration records that I had filtered down from approximately 2 million. And the filter argument was Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I'll explain why I chose that filter target in a minute.
Dave, this is Steve. I just had one brief question. Why would someone who was planning, why do you think someone who was planning a web attack would want to know whether they could be confident that they're registering as an individual?
No, that was an analogy, Steve. I mean, this is the same methods that people use to pick out a web attack are the methods that I applied to find out if I could learn a great deal about an individual to the extent that I might be able to visit his address or make a phone contact or otherwise communicate with him.
But you're not making any statement about likelihood of web attacks against him?
No, not at all.
Okay, fine.
This is just the way that people do it in the web world today.
Great, thanks.
Sure. So in addition to the domain name registration records, you know, I decided I would also follow the methodology, and I'd go and I'd use as many publicly accessible resources to collect bits and threads of information and sort of tie together things I was drawing out of registrant and administrative contact information. And the goal here was to essentially profile or piece together as much information about or derived from, you know, initially from a record to feel there was a high confidence that the registration record could definitively be said to be a personal contact or a business contact. Anecdotal information. There are plenty of publicly accessible resources beyond those that I used. If I had wanted to spend a fair amount of money and invest, you know, the same kind of time that a private investigation might employ, I could use things like, you know, the Federal Election Committee FTP site, searchsystems.net. Searchsystems.net is actually a pay portal where you then have access to 36,000 databases that are not visible in Google searches but are visible through this pay portal. And they have significantly more information, personal property records, licenses, criminal records, and the like. And they're used by law enforcement investigators, private investigators, and other people who can go fairly far into a person's history. They can get information from newspaper clippings and things like that. And so that I didn't use those resources because I thought that was going a little bit too far. It was also fairly expensive. So really, you know, what most investigators tend to do is use information like who is as a first step, much like as they would if they would go and Google and use that as a first step in a criminal investigation. And similarly, I'm just looking at the first step kind of situations. And if you're interested in the domain names of some of these places that you can get this information, I'm more than happy to share my list with you. Just send me an email. The resources that I did use are listed on slide 5. I gathered the registration records using a bulk CD purchase from someone who offered them off the web, and they were acquired in bulk using Whois protocol. At least that's what they say they do. Then I also used a real estate database, and I'll explain how I used that. Internet telephone directory, I'll explain how I used that as well. Search engines, aerial photographs of of locations within Philadelphia to distinguish a business residence from an obvious cul-de-sac in a nice little quiet suburban part of the city of Philadelphia. E-maps to also complement the aerial photographs. Company is an industry directory is called Hubers.com. Websites, and then I lived in Philadelphia for almost 30 years, and so I used my knowledge of the area as sort of additional confirmation. So I know some of the neighborhoods well enough where I can look at that address, and I might have had a friend who lived a block away, or I did I shopped at this particular area, or I know this particular area's downtown commercial, not a soul lives there, kind of environment. So using all those resources, and I'll explain the matching process in a moment, I tried to classify results in the following broad categories. There's a personal contact, and what that personal contact was an individual where the registration's name was an individual's name, and the other fields contained some sort of personal contact information. Okay. There was also sort of a subcategory here where it was a home-operated business, and the registrant operated under a fictitious name, like Mary'sEmbroidery.com. And so that was not a personal name, but everything else pointed to an apartment in a building in a residential area in a residential suburb of Philadelphia. Business contacts were obviously the opposite. This is a place where people have employees, operate under a fictitious name, have some administrative hierarchy in their information technology department, and it was very obvious that this was not, a one- or two-man operation. The other categories were domain name business. These were companies that I saw a fairly large number of domain names owned by, and did a little bit more research into the company and discovered that they were in the business of buying and speculating on domain names in one form or another. Domain name proxy agents, other areas, there are a number of ISPs and a number of companies that will essentially register domain names on behalf of their subscribers or their customers. People who do web hosting do this, and so those people fell into the category of domain name proxy agent. Then there were also records that were provided inconclusive data. Either there was insufficient information in many of the fields, or the information was completely inaccurate, or the aerial photograph was not very well distinguished. Essentially not that there weren't a sufficient number of matches in my criteria to actually come up with a conclusion that this was a personal contact or a business contact. So if you go to slide seven essentially, even though I show a picture of a fingerprint, that's more just for the purpose of providing some distraction from just more and more slides of more and more words. But essentially, the philosophy is the same. What I was looking for is a large number of things that are of matching criteria. If you look at the 10 boxes on slide 7 and slide 8, these are the kinds of questions I asked on each record that I examined. And so I went through 5,000 records, a record at a time. I went through 5,000 records, and I, looked up the address in the real estate database, or looked up neighboring addresses or blocks in the database. I looked up reverse telephone directories to see if it resolved to an actual individual or a business. I used search engines to find out something about the site based on the domain name or based on the individual. I looked at the aerial photographs that Google Earth provides to decide that, oh my God, this is a two-story brown house right in the heart of a neighborhood, that is clearly residential, or here's a nice little colonial on a cul-de-sac in the near suburbs of Philadelphia, so it actually still has a Philadelphia street address. Went to the websites. You got a sense of whether or not this is a small company or a large company. The things that that Steve Crocker and ICANN Legal and others felt were off the plate in terms of pursuing pursuing this information to to verify were actually calling people or sending them an email or driving up and knocking on the door. So I wasn't going to actually complete the process and make contact. I wanted to see if I could get a high confidence that contact could be made. Similarly with businesses, if you go to slide 8, since we're kind of running out of time, again, same kinds of questions, the same kinds of pursuit on each and every record. Some of the things that were sort of cues in business records that were distinguished from cues in residential records, for example, was if there was an apartment number, it's very likely that this was an individual, whereas if it was a suite number, it was very likely that this was a business operating in a professional office building of some sort. The other thing that I did was use proximity. If you looked at the Trulia database, I might not have actually been able to find that the home or the particular address was actually on the market, but a home on the same block might have been on the market or on a block next to it. I could then go and do some more examination using some mapping and things to say, yes, this is very clearly a residential street. It's very likely that this is a residence. So where are we now? What slide number was that? Slide 8, slide 9. I'm a little out of sequence here in my slides. So getting a little bit deeper into some of the findings, some of the information, in the records that I had, I was able to use about 4,400 of the 5,000 filtered records. That means that the others were just not sufficiently accurate or had inconclusive information to actually be useful. Out of that 4,400, as you see in the pie chart, the vast majority of the records that I had in this particular case were ComNet and Org. Wasn't intentional, it was just the way it came out. So if you look at some of the findings on slide 10, about 9% of the contacts based on registration contact fields alone were personal contacts, 56% were business contacts under the criteria and definition I had before. Then you see domain name records, domain name proxy service, and home-operated businesses. Going on to slide 11, what I tried to do here was simplify the findings because if you look at the pie chart, it gets a little bit complicated. But one of the things that I combine here is the personal contacts and the home-operated businesses because I do end up getting to an individual. So about 13.4% are there. If you combine those businesses that are not in the domain name business but are business contacts, you get about 65%. And then the domain name businesses were about 21.6%. Up until this point, what I had done was only use the information in the registrant fields. That should not say registration fields. It should say registrant fields. Sorry, I'll have to fix that. So now I decided that I would expand the investigation and say, well, what happens if Joe registers the domain name, joe.com, but he has a friend, Harry, who runs a web server, and Harry puts himself down, as the administrative contact. And are there other? So the question was: are there other individuals that might be present in the domain name registration records than the registrant proper? So if you go back and you go through the records that contain personal contacts, I found a few more that were different individuals. More that contained the contact information that identified a business contact, and more that contained inconclusive data in the administrative fields. So this would be administrative contact, administrative address, administrative email, and the like. I didn't go through the technical contact. Anecdotally, the technical contact looks like it is the most well-maintained field. Which is not surprising because it's the one that most people rely on in operations when things go wrong. Slide 13 just is some illustration of the PI illustrations of, you know, whether or not the registration name contains a first name, a surname, or the administrative contact contains a first name, a surname. Slide 14, this is sort of a summary of the degrees of inaccuracy or incompletion. So when I looked at the records, one of the things that was frustrating was that, you know, God, there are an awful lot of phone numbers missing here. So 25% of the records that I found useful were missing registrant phone number. 87% were missing registration fax. 10% were missing admin contact. 11% missing admin contact email. 12% were missing admin contact address, and 60% are missing admin contact fax. As a note and sort of an interesting subplot here, the bulk the service that I bought the CDs from doesn't give you the registrant email addresses. So you can interpret that in a couple of ways. I seriously doubt whether they're doing it because they are interested in keeping registrant privacy. On the other hand, it might be that what they're doing is using those in a different product, selling them for people who want to put together lists for unsolicited email. And in fact, that same provider, at the time when they were in operation, were selling email lists.
Dave, this is Steve. Can I ask another question here?
Sure.
If this is coming from from registrar data, the registrars aren't required to make available phone and fax number for the registrant or email. So, did you factor that in?
I didn't make any factors at all. All I'm doing is telling you what I have.
Okay.
So, I mean, I honestly, Steve, I don't have an agenda here. I wanted to give some numbers.
I understand. Yeah. I'm just asking because some of this data is not what would necessarily be in the registrar. Who is data?
That's quite possible. And since I was taking the same path that somebody who was trying to use what was publicly accessible was taking, I'd have to take that into account. And I'm not saying that even though registration fax wasn't available, it really wouldn't have made any difference for me trying to decide whether or not. Whether or not I was going to actually make contact with an individual, in the cases where I was able to draw conclusions, that was probably not as useful. Using the email wasn't going to actually, in all likelihood, get me that much closer to an individual. So,
okay, thanks.
Right?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So some of the conclusions, all we were trying to do here was offer a set of findings that people might be able to mull over when they're discussing or debating whether or not there are some privacy implications in the way that the public is able to access records through WHOIS services today. What we were able to show in the study was that about 1 in 7 records provide sufficient information to identify a personal contact. And similarly, about 1 in 7 contain insufficient information to conclusively distinguish whether the contacts are businesses or individuals. The other 84%, 86% appear to be business contacts of one form or another. In addition to those conclusions, some of the things that that I was able to draw was that there's an awful lot of incomplete data. And you had a very, very useful data point, Steve, by saying this is not necessarily the extent to which records are accurate in registrar and registry databases, but the extent to which records are accurate that are made available to the public. So one way or the other, the only comment that I'm making is that there's an awful lot of awful lot of incompleteness and inaccuracy in the information that I had, and that's you can treat that in any way you'd like. I mean, if I had better registration, there is certainly an open question as to whether if I had received the same 5,000 records from the registries, whether the information would have been more accurate. I can't argue that. But you know, if it's true that there is a preponderance of registrations that where the registrant withholds or does not provide facts, and that's becoming less and less useful bit of information, you know, one question we we could ask is there any purpose in continuing to ask for a fax? Sort of a side answer to that is how often are faxes used to contact a registrant? And so, these are just questions that come up when you look at the data. They're not necessarily criticisms. I don't know how often registrars contact contact individual registrants with a fax. I certainly have never received one. But that's not necessarily something I would expect. So.
This is Tom Keller. Do you might be having a question about your methodology?
Sure.
Well, the question I have is this, whether you only applied all your methods to domain names that were registered in the area of Philadelphia, and if you have tried to use the same kind of methodology with domain names registered in other parts of the world, if that would have the same result or not.
Okay, so answering the first part, just to give you sort of a measure of the of the labor to do it the way that I did it, I spent about 100 hours of my time and other eyeballs, in order to do this. So this is a very labor intensive piece of work, because for every record, I basically had to go through each and every one of those steps of Google search and Google Earth and real estate databases, and in many cases, it wasn't just one query; it was several queries to try to get a high confidence level. So this is a fairly labor-intensive way to go about doing it. And I chose Philadelphia because I had the advantage of knowing something about the area. If I were to go to Zurich, I would be disadvantaged because I don't know very much about it. Even though I visited there a couple of times, so I wouldn't really be able to use some of the tools that I had. However, I do think that someone who was a native of Zurich might be able to conduct the same study. And my suspicion is that they would come up with approximately the same kinds of results. But I can't make that claim. The other thing is that the information I had was largely Netcom and org. And so I don't know if registrant behavior is any different in one of the country code TLDs. Does that answer your questions? Or?
Well, yes, it does. And what I think is kind of interesting is that you assume that it's the same way. I mean, having a look at the methodology, I don't want to criticize at all, but just the way you figured out whether it's a business or a private person put on certain factors, which wouldn't be working, at least in Germany, I know that for sure, but looking at residential areas or business areas, because there's a total mix in Germany, at least, of these things, and it might be harder and totally different to find out whether a person is a person or business.
Well, if there were someone who was a 30-year native of Dusseldorf,
yes,
then would you agree that that person would have a relatively good insight into whether neighborhoods were residential or business?
Well, we don't. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. Is that, for example, the city I live in, that's 280,000 people living there, and we don't really have a residential area or a business area. That's all intermingled into one, and it's really hard to tell from just having the street address to figure out whether that could be a bureau or not. For example, the bureau I'm sitting in right now overlooks like a real large place of residential area, which is combined with business as well. So there's no real way of telling, whether this is a private person or company. I don't even want to criticize all that. It's just saying that it might not be.
That's a good data point. And obviously, living in America and living with the sort of American style of of residences, neighborhoods are residential, neighborhoods are urban or suburban, and it's fairly easy to distinguish. I mean, I could show you pictures, that of streets, because I now have, some cache on my desk of around 16 megabytes of photos that I looked at that you would unquestionably recognize as, your stereotypical American, two-story colonial home, and maybe that's not as easily applied in Germany as it is here.
Well, I guess the only thing I really want to express is that it would be really hard to apply the conclusion you have, you made in your report about what happens in the area of Philadelphia to the rest of the world. So especially if it comes to data correctness and stuff like that, there never have been any kind of researchers that have shown how, for example, the Germans or Swiss or the Italian behave in terms of data correctness or not. I know there have been a couple of studies, one of Ben Edelman, if I'm not mistaken, and I would be surprised that you would find the exact same behavior. For example, in Germany, people are very bureaucratic in some way. Look at the domain registration as an official act, and therefore might be inclined to look a little bit more after their domain names and their data that is attached to it. I'm not saying that because I want to kind of give credits to the Germans, just saying that might be very different depending on the place of birth you're just looking at. And if you have a sample of 5,000 somewhere in the world, it doesn't have to correspond with how it is in somewhere else. So the only thing I really want to put forth is that you have to be very, very careful in making conclusions that it might probably be the same situation somewhere else.
Okay, and that's a legitimate input. As I said, you know, I don't mean to be a tunnel visioned American by any.
I'm not saying so. You have to start somewhere. I probably would have started here. So I'm just doing that for the record, I guess.
Well, I think that's a very valuable input. And you know, if I were to go and try to do a study, in Germany, I probably would think of it. You know, be more familiar. Hope that I would try to become more familiar with, you know, the way that people live and behave there. And that's one of the reasons why I chose Philadelphia, because I was comfortable that I could apply the methodology with some convincing results.
David Jordan, could I ask quickly what you mentioned that 600 of the records you looked at, 456 were entirely unusable. What sorts of factors would make a record entirely unusable?
Oh, okay. Fields not present. Fields that had telephone numbers of 111111111. Fields that had names like NA or private. Just information that literally was not correct. You could tell that some of these records were submitted through input forms, like a web form, where it may have done some character check, but it didn't say, you know, this does not look like a legitimate telephone number, so I'm rejecting what you typed in, and you can't register a domain name until you give me valid input. Yeah. I mean, our process is not, you know, in many of the registration processes, there isn't a significant rigor performed on input form validation. You know, people, and by and large in the web, if you type in almost any 10-digit number, you end up getting an accept on the web form, and that's the kind of thing that people can tend to abuse. You know, same thing with emails. We don't go and verify the email in a lot of situations by building in a script that requires that you bounce back a reply before your registration is accepted. Yeah. Which, by the way, I think would be wonderful, but yeah.
Sure. So it seems like these would be records that we might characterize as sort of being facially incorrect. Is that fair?
Yeah. Assessment? Yeah, incorrect or incomplete. Yeah. I mean, there just wasn't enough there. And in some cases there was enough there, but you know, you just couldn't tell. You know, and the same, the neighborhood was ambiguous. You know, I went and I looked, and there were other apartments, buildings in the neighborhood, but there were also, you know, was a pizza building and an automobile mechanic on the same block. And so, you know, what do you do? You know, I didn't want to conclude one way or the other because I didn't want to bias the result on my own speculation. So I tossed that record into the inconclusive data record.
Right. So that's a distinct bucket from the unusable bucket.
Right.
You've got an unusable bucket and you've got an inconclusive.
Right.
And Dave, you also have this next bullet: missing information used to classify a contact. Now, is that the same thing as, I mean, where does the domain name proxy service bucket fit here. You had 562 of those. Did you treat those as missing information, or
was no? That was basically a company that actually identified itself as a domain, as an ISP. And you know, when I went and investigated their website and their service, one of the things that they did was they claimed that they would register the name for you so that you would personal information would not be exposed.
Okay, so you don't know anything about the registrant, the true registrant, if you will, in that situation, but that's a separate category.
Right. So there's you can't get to, that's the whole purpose of the proxy.
Right.
You can't get to, to the registrant, through that service.
Okay.
Yeah. Dave Ross here.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, but I am now 10 minutes past 8.
I'll be real quick. I'm not quite sure I understand the source of the data. Did you actually go to the Whois, or did you?
No. I got a, actually Ram Mohan had purchased 6 CDs with 20 some odd million registration records from a web advertising company.
Okay.
That sold the data in bulk.
So we're not actually talking about Whois data here.
Well, we're talking about registration records.
Purportedly.
And presumably, and what the purveyor of the records claim was that this was information collected using the bulk Whois.
But we're not talking about authoritative data here.
We are not talking. Well, it may be authoritative data, but it wasn't received. Well, it is not authoritative data. It was received through a third party.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Okay, sounds like we've run a bit over time already, so if there aren't any burning last-minute questions, we'd like to wrap things up with Dave and thank him for his time and let him free.
Well, thank you for giving me this opportunity, and if there's something else that you'd like to do or you want to revisit this during the ICANN meeting in Sao Paulo, just give me some advance notice so I can make some time.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, we'll turn now. We have our second report today. This is the ICANN, the compliance report that the ICANN staff has put together, and I think Mike is going to be presenting that this morning.
Yep, I'm happy to be here today. Jordan, thanks for having me. What I'd like to do is kind of give you a real high-level overview and then kind of give you some of the details that weren't explicitly published. I think that's probably what you're more interested in. I think you're capable of reading what was already posted to the website. First, I should just kind of clarify that I wasn't involved in the registry part of the audit, and so I apologize that I'm not real knowledgeable about the specifics of that. I'd be happy to try and get questions answered for you if there are things that you find that were lacking in the report that was published. I'd be happy to, try and track those sorts of things down, and I can either do that by email, or if you just want to let me know on this call, I'm happy to do that. But I do have some pretty detailed specifics on the registrar end of it, so I would like to just kind of give you the overview first, and then I'll give you kind of the details that weren't really in the report. What we reported on in the registrar part of this compliance update, and I think I don't want to overstate what the report was. This is a fairly routine thing that we were doing. Registrar renewals happen. For each registrar, it happens every 5 years, and so we conduct an audit at that time. And so one of the things that we want to do is to provide some feedback to the community about that process, and I think we try to do that periodically. In the past, I think that a lot of this data was included in our reports that were mandated by the MOU, so part of this is just being trying to be, presenting information to the community, and that's what this should be read as. What we had were 20 registrars up until the time of this report that had had accreditation agreements that were expiring or had already expired and, were either had renewed or in some process of renewal, and so the details that I've got are sort of an outline of what happened with those 20 registrars. Of the 20, we saw 17 registrars were able to renew, and some of them are still kind of in that process of returning the agreement but have been approved for renewal. There were two who voluntarily chose not to renew, and there was one who was declined a renewal accreditation agreement as a result of the compliance audit. Through this audit, we saw registrars modify their policies or practices in 18 instances. We also kept track of areas or issues in which we had received clarifications on a policy or practice by a registrar. And, it wasn't always clear whether what they were doing was clarifying or whether they were modifying a practice. So, this isn't exactly a scientific reporting, but I'm happy to try and clarify as best we can here so that you have an understanding of where we are on that. We found that 7 registrars, as a result of the renewal process, modified their contact data. That was either their ICANN contact data or their public contact data, which is published on the Internet site. And just as a matter of interest, we collected roughly $57,000 in overdue invoices as a result of the renewal process. What I'd like to do then is give you a little bit of the specifics on the areas that we saw these policy or program changes at registrars. I think that probably, obviously, this task force is most interested in sort of the who is data areas, but there were roughly 9 or 10 different areas that I can kind of give you the overview on. The first was generally the UDRP. We asked a few questions about how UDRP complaints are handled and what sorts of things registrars were doing to ensure that names are not getting transferred during the course of a dispute. 2 registrars changed their policies or practices as a result of the audit to more appropriately adhere to the requirements of the UDRP. Let's see here. We had one of the areas of the renewal application involves the part of the registrar accreditation agreement, which requires registrars to obtain reasonable assurance of payment before activating a registration. We had no registrars were required to change their policies or practices in relation to that. However, we had 5 registrars who clarified their practices so that we were able to determine that they were in compliance. 3 registrars modified their practices related to the EDDP. This is the expired domain deletion policy, requiring the registrars to delete a name within 45 days of its expiration if it's not renewed by or on behalf of the registrant. 5 registrars clarified their practices, but none were required to modify their practices in relation to who is data accuracy. And specifically, the questions that we're asking are, how do you handle complaints about inaccurate who is data? How many do you receive? Generally, we found of the registrars who were applying for renewal had been acting responsibly in their obligations to take reasonable steps to ensure that who is data is accurate. 3 registrars modified their registration agreements related to the jurisdictional or venue provisions of that are required by the registrar accreditation agreement. Specifically, what that sets out is that legal disputes can be brought by third parties related to use of a domain name, either in the jurisdiction of the registrar or in the jurisdiction of the registrant. Just one clarification related to the transfer policy. There were no policy changes required there. One registrar modified its form of authorization that's used to obtain authorization for transfers. The RNAP, and I'm forgetting what that stands for. Just give me a second here. RNAP. Restored Names Accuracy Policy. That's it. We had no registrars were required to change their practices to clarify their practices. Specifically, the RNAP requires that before a name is restored after having been deleted for inaccurate data, the registrar has to take steps to ensure that the data that's provided upon the redemption is actually accurate. The WDRP, this is the Who is Data Reminder Policy, we had one registrar change its practices to come into compliance and 3 clarified their practices. Specifically, the WDRP requires registrars to notify all registrants of GTLD names once a year. Of the details of the registration, specifically, they're required to present to them their WHOIS data and remind them that providing inaccurate data would be grounds for termination of their registration. Looks like the largest area that we saw activity here was in WHOIS access terms, and specifically, we reviewed the access agreement for all registrars, port 43 WHOIS service and web-based WHOIS service. And we required that their terms are in alignment with the terms of the RAA. One of the common themes that we saw was that registrars were more restrictive than they were permitted to be under the RAA, And while we don't specifically have a position on the amount of data or the privacy or any of these issues, what we are enforcing is the requirements of the RAA, which specifically would permit a person to use who is data, theoretically, for postal mail. And a lot of registrars had prohibited that practice in their terms of access. And then, as I said, the RAA would require or would preclude a registrar from forbidding use of their WHOIS data for postal mail. In the area of record retention, all registrars we found were in compliance, although we did have five registrars clarify to us what their programs were. Specifically, some registrars had notified us or had indicated they retained their records indefinitely, and we just clarified that meant at least 8 years or at least the term of their RAA plus 3 years. And finally, the last area that we looked at was registration agreements between resellers and registrants, and there we didn't see that any policy changes or practices were required to be changed as a result of the renewal process. There were just two clarifications in that area. So that's kind of the detailed analysis of the renewals part of our compliance update. Before I move on to the non-renewal part of this, were there any questions about how that all came about?
Yeah, Mike, this is Steve Metallitz. One of the first things you just mentioned, you obviously went through this very quickly, was the UDRP,
mm-hmm.
and I think you said two registrars had to modify or clarify, but what was sent out today says 11 registrars. Is this, are we talking about the same thing here, or this two different things?
There were nine registrars who clarified for us what their policies or practices were to ensure that they were in compliance. There were two who modified either their policies or practices. I think the thing that went out may have said there were total 11 because this is probably one of those instances where there were cases where it was ambiguous where a registrar was actually changing its practice or whether it was explaining that its practice was correct. We tend to give them, you know, the benefit of the doubt, and if it appears to be a clarification, you know, we're not so much interested in a pound of flesh on this. You know, what we want to ensure is that, you know, going forward, registrars are adhering to the requirements. So in this case, you know, there were two specific changes. There were 11 instances where we investigated further than just simply accepting the answer that was provided by the registrar.
Okay, and this sentence also talks about two issues, implementing UDRP decisions mm-hmm. and ensuring that registrants agree to the terms of the UDRP. Do you
right.
have information on which was involved there?
Let me just look here. I don't have specific details, but from memory, I believe that there was one case where a registrar had, where we felt that their inclusion of the UDRP wasn't probably as clear as it could have been, and so we asked them to clarify that. In the other instance, it was a case of a registrar. I think during the course of their renewal, we found an instance where they had, you know, not implemented the decision in a timely manner, and so we included that as part of our renewal review to ensure that they had practices in place or policies in place that would ensure that there were not future problems with that.
Mike Ross here for a follow-up if Steve's done.
Yeah, go ahead.
You were talking about the use or the sort of the restrictions that registrars were putting on the use of data for marketing purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd mentioned that postal mail was something that would be permitted under the registrar accreditation agreement.
You know, if you look at the RAA, there are two different places where they deal with how WHOIS data can be used.
Yep.
And in the, let me just pull it up here. At paragraph 3.3.6, the agreement talks about bulk access to data, and that was modified by the WHOIS. There's a pause here. The WMRP, the WHOIS Marketing Restriction Policy, and that one would actually, that one addresses postal data.
Mm-hmm.
But as you look at paragraph 3.3.5, that deals with sort of the one-off access to the WHOIS server rather than the bulk access to data. And that one specifically does not permit a registrar to include a exclusion for postal mail.
Gotcha. You caught me not half listening, so I was just wondering what the scope of that comment was. So thank you.
Well, and you know, I tend to, you know, I mean, I don't always have the RA in front of me, so I tend to sometimes abbreviate more than I should. If you're looking,
Mike, you should have it memorized by now. Thank you.
Any other questions on the renewal process before I move on to the other piece of this? Okay. Well, let me then go into the other piece, and this is beginning fairly early in August. Our ICANN CEO had indicated he wished for us to, you know, have statistics available in terms of what sorts of compliance efforts we're undertaking on kind of a maybe informal is not the right word, but more of an ad hoc basis, and he wanted to track, you know, what sorts of efforts we're putting into issues, what sorts of issues we're seeing trends in, and to be able to provide feedback to the community on that sort of thing, because I think that in the past it was something that we didn't have very good accessibility to that data. I think that as we've got more staffing resources, it's something that we're a little bit better able to do. We're still kind of developing the methodology for this. What we've begun with is tracking the complaints. What you're looking at are specifically complaints that I've handled through receiving from a staff member at ICANN, either who answers the ICANN at ICANN.org email address, transfer questions email address, the registrar info, which is the email address that's used to submit registrar complaints at the internet. And so these sort of, as people get complaints through these different channels, those that are believed to involve a compliance issue are forwarded for review in this update. So that's the data here that's included in our report. So in what we reported, there were roughly 2 months of data. We found that there were 33 potential compliance issues, and things that were clearly non-jurisdictional. For example, issues involving web hosting or you know, spam or you know, various content-related areas. We didn't include in this at all. I mean, it was just clearly ruled out as a non jurisdictional sort of thing. So we looked at 33 different issues. On average, we were able to close them within 4 days of the 31 that were closed by the time of our reporting. 18 were closed without any formal compliance action. This may have been something simple like a person was unable to get a name unlocked or to obtain an auth code. In 7 instances, we saw registrars change their practices or policies as a result of the compliance action. 3 of these compliance tickets were referred to the transfer dispute resolution policy because they were brought by registrars about another registrar or registrar's adherence to the transfer policy. And finally, 3 issues were resolved with further oversight by ICANN. I gave a report to the registrar's constituency last week, Tuesday, and what I did in preparation for that, I just took my spreadsheet that I've been keeping on compliance statistics so that I had something a little bit more current, and I've got some data here that I'd like to share with you. This is as of 24 October. So the numbers aren't going to match. They're not going to add up to 33 on here because this isn't keyed necessarily to the report that was published, but this is pretty much the most up-to-date and accurate information that I can give you. So I'll just kind of walk you through it here. We saw over the roughly 2.5 to 3 months that we were tracking these statistics, we saw 13 tickets were raised related to who is compliance. Specifically, 4 of those involved port 43, who is availability. 4 of those involved web-based, who is availability. 3 involved population of who is fields as specified in the registrar accreditation agreement, and 2 involved who is data accuracy. I think, you know, what I can tell you more specifically from memory is that generally, with the port 43 availability, I think probably half the instances were cases where a registrar's who is appeared just not to be functioning, and the other 2 instances were instances where the who is service was not returning records on specific. In terms of the web-based who is availability, we discovered that there were 4 registrars who were not providing web-based who is availability, and 3 of those 4 were actually affiliated with each other through some, you know, shared ownership structuring or however. These were registrars who were not actively putting out a retail front but were more involved in the expired domain catching. And I think there may have been some misunderstanding as to what they were required to provide to the public in terms of a WHOIS tool. So they were able to, within a day or two, come into compliance and make sure that they were all providing a web-based WHOIS interface. So that's kind of the area sort of specific to WHOIS. I'd be happy to walk through the other areas that we saw compliance issues, but I'm sure that this is probably where you'd like to probe further if there's anything that you'd like to know more. Are there questions in particular about these WHOIS issues that came up?
Mike, this is Steve. I just had a question about your third category there, population of the WHOIS data fields. Does that mean there were fields where there was no data, or you distinguish that from WHOIS data accuracy, so I wondered if you could explain.
Sure. The population of WHOIS fields comes from paragraph 3.3.1 of the RAA, and specifically that enumerates certain fields that a registrar must publish. So, for example, registrant name and address, admin, technical contact, name, address, email, phone number. Specifically, I think in these we were seeing cases where registrars were not including all of the required fields. It wasn't a matter of the field not being populated by the registrant. It was actually the registrar wasn't providing the field in its WHOIS output. As an example, there was one registrar who provided registrant name and address and nothing more. And obviously that doesn't comply with the requirements of the RAA. So we went back and insisted that they fully populate that, and that was corrected pretty easily. I think that there is a concern by I suspect, and I'm speaking without having good facts, but I think it's among sort of the smaller registrars that they want to ensure that they're protecting the best interest of the registrants. They may not be thinking about the consequences of not adhering to the requirements of the RAA, or may not even be thinking that there are specifications that are set out. So I think that's probably where most of that comes about. In terms of WHOIS data accuracy, these sorts of issues were things where a user would file, let's say, a WDPRS report about a domain name and bring through a formal action or however, that there was inaccurate WHOIS data, somehow bring this to a staff member's attention that hadn't been addressed, and we saw that, in these instances, we would ask the registrar to explain what action had been taken or to take the appropriate action. And so that's coming from the provisions in the RAA that require the registrar to take reasonable steps toward ensuring data accuracy.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions related to the WHOIS part of this? All right, well, I'll give you just kind of the brief, really brief listing of the other areas that we addressed to kind of give you some perspective in the scope of WHOIS-related complaints. So as I said, we had 13 compliance tickets related to WHOIS between roughly August 7th and October 24th. We had three compliance issues involving registrars and their being overdue on invoices. We had one issue of a reseller actually using the ICANN accredited logo without authorization or without having entered into a licensing agreement. We had 20 tickets raised related to the transfer policy specifically, four related to registrars providing off codes, five related to registrars either using or providing upon request the FOA for obtaining authorization, five issues related to locking and unlocking, and then there's six that were sort of uncategorized. Generally, these related to a registrant's ability to update their email address or in other way get information about the ability to transfer domain names. We had seven issues related to the UDRP. I said seven. Yeah, seven. Four related to registrars implementing decisions in a timely manner, and three of them involving the locking of a domain name or otherwise preventing transfer upon commencement of an UDRP action. And so that concludes the sort of the summary of what we were seeing in terms of compliance tracking. One of the things that we're looking at going forward as an emerging issue is registrars populating WHOIS data within 24 hours of activation of new registrations. It appears that there's been some misunderstanding about this in the registrar community, and we're trying to do some outreach here to clarify the differences in it. And I think we talked about this on the last call that I was on, and that's that registrars are required to update registries with WHOIS data within 5 days, but they're required to populate their own WHOIS data within 24 hours of activation of a new registration. So that's something that we're continuing to work on going forward. Any other questions for me?
Hey. Thanks, Mike. I think we don't have any other topics on the agenda today, and we had limited ourselves to just reviewing these two reports. So I think that will probably wrap up the call. We'll meet again next week with a bunch of substantive topics. Hopefully, I'm going to send out a somewhat more detailed agenda in the next couple of days, but I'm hoping that we can address many of the substantive issues that we have left. And I think, Maria, do you think that based on some of the comments, dialogue we've been having back and forth, that we're likely to see a revised version of the report between now and then as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm working on basically trying to pull together a lot more of the discussion that we had on the various proposals, so to make it a bit more substantive and a bit more of a guide for the public comments and for potential readers. So I expect to have that out to the task force within the next couple of days.
Great. So people can be on the lookout.
Yeah, and also because it will be quite a bit more substantive, there may well be some more discussions to be had on it, so that's a heads up.
So in any case, I think I'd like to thank Mike again for his time and joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll wrap up this call. There will be a transcript of this call, and we'll wrap up this call and meet again next week.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Jordan. Bye.